Welcome to Storytelling for Impact, the podcast about people who tell stories that change the world. I'm Susanna Birkwood, an international journalist turned NGO communications professional with over a decade's experience working for some of the world's best known media and nonprofit organisations. In episode 3, we meet Rachel Erskine, a storyteller who works for Amref Health Africa, an NGO which in recent years has put enormous thought into ethical storytelling. During her decade in the NGO sector, Rachel has gathered humanitarian stories everywhere from Afghanistan to Nepal, where in 2015 she interviewed survivors of the earthquake which ravaged the country. She's also involved in People in the Pictures, a group which is trying to encourage NGOs to think a bit more carefully about the way they represent the people they work with in their storytelling. I've been following the work of this group for some time, so I was thrilled to get Rachel on the show to get her take on some of the trickier ethical questions in this space. Questions like, what was so wrong about that image Daisy Dooley shared of herself holding an African child on Instagram a couple of years ago? And shouldn't NGO storytellers who interview people in the field receive more support for their mental health? This episode, I hope, will really make you think. Okay, well, hello, Rachel, and thank you so much for joining us for the podcast. So could you tell us a bit about your role at Amref and a time that you've been really proud of the impact that you've been able to have through your work?
Oh, wow. What an opener. So I manage communications for Amref Health Africa in the UK. So Amref is a Nairobi-based public health NGO, and we work mainly with women and girls on health system strengthening and just really improving their and how they can access those services. So in terms of what I'm proud of, I guess whenever we put out a piece of content or tell a story that I feel is in line with our ethics and values, and I think when we see that resonate with people and see people engaging and responding, and that's really gratifying.
Look, I have to say, it really does feel like Amref is punching above its weight and leading the way, you know, in terms of NGO communications, showing some certainly much bigger organisations how perhaps it can be done. But we obviously talk a lot about the successes and the impact that it's possible to have. I'm also interested to know, have there been any times when you haven't been able to affect change through your storytelling, through your content gathering, and how you've coped with that?
Well, I think I feel very lucky to work for Amref for a number of reasons. And I think because we are a slightly smaller organisation, we do have a bit more freedom to innovate and do things a little bit differently than maybe a bigger organisation with a heavier bureaucracy. And it's really great because I think the whole organisation is on board with this way of doing things, with the sort of ethical storytelling agenda. And that's not something I've always experienced in previous roles. So I've definitely struggled with that in the past. And I think even throughout my career, I've been working in this sector for a decade now. And certainly I'm much more aware of the power dynamics and the way the sector is structured. And I guess the power that the sector has and collectively has and has had over the past few decades to shape public perceptions of particular parts of the world and individuals or groups of people. And I think, yeah, we're at a point where we really have to recognise that power and take responsibility for it, and also take responsibility for the harm that we might have caused in the past. And I know that my own thinking has evolved, and I think I hope that I'm much more sensitive than I have been in the past when taking a picture or commissioning photography or talking to somebody about their experience. And I guess in terms of frustrations, it's often hard in communications to know what impact your work has. I think we're part of a much broader process, and we don't always have direct contact with some of the audiences that, for example, the fundraising or programs teams might be engaging with. So I guess I don't often see the reaction of the end user or the consumer of whatever product I've produced. So I don't know what, if any, change I've contributed to, and whether that's raising funds or kind of moving somebody to take action or even changing someone's perception. So I guess I've got used to yeah, I'm happy if I put out a good piece of content and the person who is being depicted is also happy with the image that's reflected back at them. I guess that's become my kind of barometer for success.
That's really interesting. So you're content, by the sounds of things, with controlling what you're able to control. You know, your remit is putting out really powerful, accurate, authentic, engaging content, and you put your energy into that and let the rest take care of itself.
That's definitely what I'm aiming for.
Yeah, I know. Well, look, it definitely sounds like a very healthy perspective and one that I would do well to remember, I think, myself sometimes. It's, you know, psychologically quite tempting to try and overstep and try and fix everything that you see and all the suffering that you encounter firsthand. And
for sure.
Looking to control your piece of the puzzle and do your bit and let other actors hopefully do what is incumbent on them is obviously a really healthy way of looking at things. Now, your work has taken you to lots of different countries, Afghanistan, Jordan, Myanmar, Nepal, Sudan, Kenya, Ethiopia. I wondered if you could share maybe one of your most memorable experiences of content gathering in the field. Could be the most emotional, the most dangerous, the funniest, the weirdest experience you've had. You choose.
Sure. Well, there's definitely been a lot of weird ones. I have frequently found myself in very absurd and improbable situations. And I think probably a really useful skill to have in this line of work is that sense of absurdity and ability to laugh at situations and especially at yourself. But I think probably the most difficult content gathering mission that I have been on is to Nepal. You mentioned I went to Nepal just after the first earthquake in 2015. So I think that the earthquake happened on a Saturday. We were all in the office on the Sunday and I was in a plane on the Monday. So I was working for a different organization at the time and a more sort of humanitarian disaster response relief organization. So a very different type of beast to AMREF. But I think that was very tough in terms of the conditions. There were still a lot of aftershocks ongoing. And it was the first time that I had been in the immediate aftermath of a disaster like that. And I wasn't sure that I was up to it, that I was strong enough. And then on top of that, I think that's probably one of the situations where those ethical considerations really came into play. And I really realised the stakes, I suppose, because the people I was speaking to had been through something incredibly traumatic. And in fact, it was ongoing. There was still a lot of chaos and confusion. We didn't know in those first few days the true impact. And as I say, there were aftershocks ongoing. And then, indeed, there was a second earthquake a couple of weeks later. So that was a really tricky situation to be in. And I think it made me aware of a lot of these ethical considerations and also the overlap with safeguarding in a situation like that. And the responsibility that you have going into that situation, being an outsider and talking to people about things that are incredibly hard, especially when you have an imperative, because in that situation, we were putting out an emergency appeal and we were trying to report back on a sort of daily basis to the people who had contributed to that appeal to let them know what their support was doing. But in those early days, it was very hard to make that clear. So it was more about sort of illustrating the needs. And obviously, then you're telling some pretty hard stories. So yeah, that was something that really sticks in my mind. And I guess looking back at it now, there are things that I did then that I probably wouldn't do now, or that I would just be a lot more careful and sensitive about.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell us a bit more about
that? Well, I think just really interviewing people who have just been through something incredible and they're still reeling, you know, they're still in shock. People who had lost members of their family or had lost their homes or somebody was missing and they were incredibly worried or they themselves had been injured. Now I would probably be more delicate. And I think in a lot of these situations, for me, one of the really important things when you're collecting a story or interviewing somebody is just to give it time and space and, you know, take the time to get to know the person and have those conversations around consent. And in that sort of emergency situation, the consent thing maybe tends to be an afterthought. And I think that's something I would definitely approach a lot more delicately now and be much more forward and open about giving the person the possibility to revoke their consent, because they may well have said yes in the moment when they were still very sort of heightened emotions and maybe they wouldn't be so happy even in that situation a few days down the line, and they might have changed their minds. But because things were moving so quickly, we probably didn't go back to them in the way that I ordinarily would want to do.
But it also made me think, you know, meeting these people that have been through incredibly traumatic experiences so recently, whether there's enough support for content gatherers themselves after having these interactions and having these encounters, not only hearing the most horrifying stories, having to process them and output something which hopefully generates impact, but also just the sense of helplessness that you can feel at not being able to immediately, at least, affect change in the lives of these people.
Yes, I think that's true. And we're not journalists. We are in this strange sort of limbo land. When you have conversations with people, then they're entrusting their story to you. And that gives you this incredible responsibility. And it's an immense privilege to be able to share those stories. But yeah, I guess you want to go about it the right way and in a way that doesn't cause harm. And I think you're right about support. I mean, I don't know what it's like in the journalism world. I think there's an increasing recognition that particularly aid workers who work in crises, sort of in sudden onset crises, need a very rigorous and robust sort of offboarding processes as well as onboarding, and mental health is a big part of that. And definitely I was very fortunate at that time, the organisation that I worked for did offer counselling and to staff, and I did take up that opportunity a few weeks after I got back because I was feeling pretty a lot of things, among them guilt, and you know, questioning my own sort of behaviour and reactions. But I definitely think, I mean, there's the aftermath, but there's also the pre and the prep. And there's a lot to be said for training people, and especially so, you know, training in terms of, you know, personal security and identifying and dealing with hazards, but also interactions and human relationships, I guess. And I think that's possibly an area where as a sector we could be stronger.
Look, it's fantastic to hear though that you were offered counselling. I'm curious to know whether that was counselling that was specific to the kind of work that you'd been doing. Was it people that were knowledgeable about the kinds of, I don't know, ethical dilemmas and anxieties that someone's likely to have after an experience
like
that?
Interestingly, yes. So I was working in France at the time, in Paris, and there is a kind of network of therapists who are specialised in the humanitarian field and in fact have experience of doing that job themselves. So the person that I spoke to was part of a practice where I think there were two of them. And so I spoke to him when I got back, and actually his business partner had been on the plane with me on the way to Nepal. He had been going out to provide psychosocial support to people who had been affected immediately by the earthquake. Yeah.
So he knew exactly what you were facing and very much knew the context.
Yeah, and I think maybe that's unusual. I hope it's becoming less so. That was 2015, and I think it's becoming much more normal and sort of built into HR processes. For me, it was slightly, I felt I had a bit of a responsibility to deal with everything I was feeling and to sort of process those emotions.
Yeah,
because it was having an impact on my job, I would say.
Definitely. You've talked a little bit, kind of alluded to some of the things that concern you about the way NGO storytelling can be done, or perhaps traditionally has been done. Could you maybe take us back to a time when you've witnessed something happening, maybe has caused some harm?
That's a good question. I think our sector possibly has been guilty in the past of telling stories that have lacked depth and lacked breadth, and not showing people as full, well-rounded people with a lot of things going on in their lives beyond the relationship that they have with the NGO in question. So one thing we really try to do at AMREF is show people as people and not just you know, community health workers, but maybe also or people living with HIV AIDS or whatever their relationship to AMREF is, but also showing the role they play within their families and communities, what they're interested in, you know, their pastimes, and just trying to really give a sense of the full person. But to go back to your question, I think something I keep coming back to is the Stacey Dooley incident. I think a lot of different dynamics are kind of play out in and are concentrated in that one example, because obviously that was her. Those were pictures she had posted through her personal account when she was on a filming trip with Comic Relief to Uganda. And I think you really have to give credit to Comic Relief for the changes they've made recently, and they have so much influence in this sector that is really a significant shift. But I think what was interesting about that was that first of all, there were the images themselves, which showed the people she was meeting, and especially this little boy as quite passive. He didn't really have any agency. He wasn't looking at the camera. There was no context. We didn't know what his name was. We didn't know where he lived. We didn't know anything about his family. We don't know about consent. So there was that. But then on top of that, when she was initially challenged on the fact that she'd posted the picture, she was quite defensive and refused to engage or accept that she might have done anything wrong, even if it was unintentional. And I think we can learn a lot from that, because a big thing for me on a personal level and also as an organisation, I think we have to be really aware of the difference between our intention and the impact of our actions. So we can very well mean well and not set out to harm, but we have channeled the story through our own lens, and we've brought our own experiences and our own bias to that. And so it could be that the picture we end up painting of the person is not one they're happy with. And even if our intentions were good, I think we just have to always be really ready to hear that we've not done a good job, and that we may have caused harm or made someone unhappy. So yeah, for me, that's always a really good example to have in mind, about not just the act, but the sort of motivations behind it, I guess, and then the repercussions and the ripple effect for the boy and his family.
Yeah, and it feels like being willing to take feedback is a really crucial point.
And I think
there.
Yeah, for all of us, it's really important. That's probably one of the biggest learnings for me, and something I'm constantly working on, is just to be better at that. And it's something we're trying to build into our policies and processes too, especially around consent, is that sort of, yeah, as I've said before, giving people the chance to revoke their consent if whatever the final product is, it doesn't sit well with them.
Now, Rachel, you are co-chair of something called People in the Pictures. What is it?
So the People in the Pictures is a working group that is housed by Bond, which is the umbrella organisation that represents humanitarian and international development organisations in the UK. And it grew out of a piece of research that was done by Jess Crombie and Siobhan Warrington through Save the Children at the time. And it was quite a pioneering piece of research that was conducted in, I think, 5 different countries and over a period of several years, where they talked to people who had been involved in content production and image making, and they talked to them not just about the final products, but about their experience of producing the content and how involved they had felt and to what extent they had been given the chance to sort of voice their opinions and shape the story. And that is a really good read for anybody who is interested. It's available online. It sprang from there, and now it is housed by Bond. And we hold meetings every quarter or so. And it's all about really just, I guess, encouraging the sector to adopt more ethical practices in terms of storytelling and representation. And the focus is very much on practically what can each of us do as individuals and within our organisations. And so we like to have people come in and share experiences, talk about changes they've made in their own organisations. We have a lot of case studies. We have quite practical workshops. We have people come in, photographers. And so it's really an interesting group to be part of. And I think what's really, for me, coming from a relatively small organisation, what's cool is that I guess we're all facing quite similar challenges. And it's a really good way of drawing inspiration and encouragement from peers. We had a really interesting meeting last summer in, I think, August, around race and representation in INGO communications. And that was the best attended meeting we've had to date. So we had a really fantastic panel representing a whole range of organisations, sharing their experiences. And that felt really sort of practical and frank, I think. And that's the type of conversation that we need to be having if we want things to change for good and for the better.
Yeah, no, that was super interesting. I was having a little listen to that earlier, actually. And what are you in the group working on
really
now?
Just sort of taking it to the next level. And our most recent meeting was around how can we ethically tell stories and produce content, but also raise funds. Because I think a lot of the nervousness around doing things differently comes from the lack of evidence. And I suppose because we've been doing things a certain way as a sector for years and even decades now. And I think there's a lot of apprehension around, well, if we do things differently, will people come with us? And will we be able in our comms and our fundraising to elicit those same emotions in people that motivate them to support us and to give, or whatever form their support takes? So we really wanted to focus on that and bring in concrete examples of organisations that had shifted the way they tell their stories and found that it resonated with their supporters. So at the moment, we are thinking about the themes of our meetings for the rest of the year. And so, yes, we really want to crowdsource ideas. So I would really encourage anybody who's a member of Bond to join.
Fantastic. Now, a lot of organisations, because of COVID-19, wherever they're based in the world, have been forced to kind of think a bit out of the box when it comes to their content gathering this past year. And it's seen kind of international organisations often relying perhaps a bit more on in-country colleagues, sometimes producing things which are maybe a little bit less polished, as a result, perhaps a bit more authentic. Do you think that this is going to happen more going forward once COVID-19 is hopefully a thing of the past? And do you think that it should, from an ethical perspective?
I do, yeah. I think it will, and I think it should. I think that's the right thing. And I think if you are working in a comms role, a storytelling role for an NGO, and you're thinking about doing things differently, I think now is the time to try, because the landscape has shifted so much and will continue to shift. And I think it's an opportunity to try new things. And at AMREF, we have found we are among those organisations that have been producing content that is, as you say, a little bit less polished, a little rougher around the edges. But I think it's actually a good thing, because it is more authentic and more timely. And I think it can go a long way to reducing that distance that we typically have and have created between the people that we're working with, the contributors, and the people who are supporting our work. So I've seen loads of really good user-generated content and participatory stuff coming out, and within the People in the Pictures group, we've also heard examples of organizations starting podcasts and just rethinking the way they do things and how to tell stories and connect, I guess. And also I think we've seen that sense of solidarity coming across quite strongly in a lot of NGO storytelling. So the fact that there isn't really anybody in the world who hasn't been affected by COVID, and we are all in the same storm, but we're not all in the same boat. And I think there's been some really nice storytelling that's come out around that sort of theme about the universal impact, but also the uneven nature of that impact.
I definitely think there's a growing feeling that Europeans and Americans in particular shouldn't be telling the stories of Africans. And I've worked as a content gatherer and felt enormously privileged to have the role, but almost couldn't believe my luck that, you know, there was an NGO that was willing to send me to the other side of the world to tell stories of people that I met just for a few days. And, you know, this is the first time that I'd ever had any real exposure to their culture and their way of life. And I did sometimes question, you know, fortunate though I felt, was I necessarily the very best person to be telling those stories? Yeah. But I mean, I'm curious to know, do you think that people like you and I from the Global North, who are skilled at doing this and have been doing this, do we still have a part to play in this paradigm? Do we have a role to play in helping to convey those stories to audiences in this part of the world in a way that they can relate to?
Yeah, it's such a good question. And it's one I ask myself pretty much every day without really having found an answer. I think there is still space, and I think we can still be useful. But the way I would tend to see my role is more as a kind of channel for other people's stories. So not really telling them, but just creating spaces and opportunities and platforms for people to tell their own stories. And that's something that we're trying to do more of at AMREF, is just kind of get out of the way and let people speak for themselves and connect them to audiences in the UK. And I think, yeah, we've seen a lot of positive shifts since the coronavirus crisis too, in terms of much bigger uptake of creatives, videographers, photographers in country who are from those countries. And that's fantastic, because there's no lack of talent in other parts of the world. So I hope that's something that will continue. And I think there's been a real recognition that those networks are out there and all we have to do is call on them. But I think the broader question remains. And yeah, I haven't quite found an answer. Maybe it's an ongoing question. I think asking yourself the question is really important, and everybody has to find something that they can kind of live with. But yeah, I think we, as people in the global north who traditionally have had the power to shape perceptions, we really have to recognize that power and, as I say, take responsibility for the, I guess, the stereotypes that we have reinforced over time, and really look for new ways of doing things and being braver and being bolder, and yeah, creating opportunities and amplifying experts from the majority world, the global south, who really are experiencing things firsthand, and who better to consult, really. I think it is an exciting time to be working in the sector and be working in comms in the sector, because things are changing, and they're changing very quickly, and certainly a lot of those changes are overdue. But I think if we are able to use our position and use our power to accelerate those changes, I think right now I feel that's the most useful thing I can be doing.
Rachel, would you be able to tell us a bit more about how AMREF has made efforts to tell more authentic stories? And I'm also aware that one of the things that you do is you try, where possible, to circle back to contributors to your stories and give them a chance to see and approve of their photos and perhaps information that's going out about them. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Sure, yeah. So I suppose I should start by explaining the work we have done over the past couple of years around consent. So about, I'd say, 3 years ago, we really realised that we had a lot of really beautiful imagery that we couldn't really use because we didn't have written proof of consent. And so we had probably invested more heavily in the gathering of the content and the stories, and less so in making sure that we were gathering and storing consent in a sort of robust and rigorous and thoughtful way. So we realised that by doing that, we had all these images that we couldn't use, but we were also there was a bit of risk for the organization, because one thing I've definitely noticed in my recent impact reporting visits to our projects is just how people are increasingly aware of their rights and willing to claim them when it comes to owning and using their image. So we put together a global task force to look at consent across the organization, because nobody has enough task forces in their life already. And so we had people from across the organisation coming together and reviewing it in a really thorough way, and trying to make sure that we were thinking about the dynamics of image making and consent in all the different countries where we work, because it's very different. Just the whole act of taking a photo and what it means can really vary from one community to the next, and even between individuals. So we started with that, developing a new policy and a set of tools. And it was really crucial that the tools would be accessible and usable, not just to comms people, but also to programs people, who in a lot of cases are often the ones taking pictures, because they're the ones that are most often on project sites and talking to communities. So basically that process threw up all these other questions about imagery and why we take pictures and what we do with them, and what story we're trying to tell, and whose story we're trying to tell, and what perspective we're coming from. And so I guess that led us to a broader review of photography and story gathering. But I think for us, it was such a useful exercise. It was a very long and cumbersome one, and it's by no means finished, because we've committed to reviewing it every year as thinking and best practice evolve. We still have more tools and more training to roll out, especially for programs teams. But I think doing that exercise was so useful, and it really underpins so much of what we do in terms of our storytelling, because it's all about just time and relationships and taking the time to properly have that conversation and make sure that people know what they're agreeing to, and not just, you know, the act of taking the photo, but also who's going to see the photo, in what context it's going to appear, how it's going to be framed. And especially when it's for digital storytelling, you know, really once the image is out there in the world, you do lose a lot of control over it. So you really have to think about the implications and make sure that the person who's pictured also is aware of those implications.
Now look, the cynic in me wonders that with the move to more small authentic storytelling, are NGOs just going to choose which projects they show and choose to be authentic about these great programs which are doing well, but perhaps not shining the spotlight on the programs and the projects which aren't what they'd want the public to see?
Yes, for sure. I think that's a really good thing to flag. and thing for us to be aware of and avoid when we're talking about the ethics of storytelling. Honesty is a big part of it, being honest with ourselves and what we're trying to do and being honest with our audiences. And I suppose, yeah, you're right, absolutely, we shouldn't be cherry picking. And I guess that's something we all have to sort of just, we just have to do it really, don't we? And we also have to trust our audiences, I think, to sort of go on that journey with us and be understanding. And because they're smart, our supporters are really smart, and you know, they have strong opinions and they have expectations of us, and we have to meet those expectations, but we also have to, I guess, meet them where they're at and be, I think we all have to be open to things changing, because I think we all know that it's the right way to go.
I think shining the spotlight on things that haven't worked is really important. I think it's more likely that organisations will stop working on certain projects which just aren't effective if they are communicated, as well as the projects that are doing fantastically well. And I do think that there are audiences that, you know, will appreciate, like you say, the honesty, and it will help to build credibility, the fact that NGOs are talking about their failures as well as their successes. Having said that, there are obviously audiences, particularly perhaps the media, who are likely to be highly critical if the way that some projects are run is shown just as it is. There's definitely reputational risks. Just wondering if you've got any thoughts about that balance, or whether you feel that, you know, at the end of the day, it's the greater good that we are honest and authentic, and that's what we have to aim for, whatever the consequences.
Wow, what a question. Yeah, I think it's such a tricky one, and especially the environment we're working in at the moment, the broader environment is such a tricky one for INGOs and overseas development aid, and yeah, it's a really tricky climate for us to be negotiating. I think there's a balance between being prepared to maybe take a slight financial hit, but also, I guess, in the longer term, I hope that doing things differently and more ethically will open us up to new audiences who perhaps are believers in the idea of international development or humanitarian work, and but are perhaps a bit more cynical, and they've been hearing these stories for years and years about, you know, the negative reporting in the press and the recent scandals around the sector, and that has made them very rightfully so, you know, a bit more discerning, and they have high expectations of us, and I think maybe that will ultimately help us evolve as a sector too. But I suppose there's also participatory photography and perhaps less positive stories coming out, and I suppose there's also a strong argument for incorporating that into our M&E and our project development. I think the more we listen to the people and the communities we are meant to be serving, the better. So if those stories turn out not to be so rosy, great, let's use that as data and evidence to make sure that we do better next time. There's no more powerful testament than from the people we're meant to be serving.
I just wanted to mention that many years ago, around about 2008, AMREF Health Africa did a partnership with The Guardian where, you know, local journalists and Guardian journalists were embedded in one of your projects.
Yes, in Katina in Uganda, yeah.
And I mean, that's a really interesting example of just opening up everything to be scrutinised and to be reported on. It was a long-term reporting project as well, wasn't it? Over a couple of years?
Yeah, I think it was 2 or 3 years. It was before my time, but it was quite a defining moment in AMREF's history, I think, especially in the UK. Yeah, and I think that's probably had ripple effects for us, because I think we've been asking these questions about ethical storytelling and interrogating the way we do things for a number of years now, before I arrived, certainly, which was in late 2017. And yeah, I don't know if the fact that we are Nairobi-based and Nairobi-led makes us a slightly different, you know, we're structured a little bit differently, and maybe these questions were asked a little bit earlier in our life, in the lifespan than some of our peers. I don't know. But yeah, that is such an interesting example. And for, yeah, nearly 3 years ago now, we made a commitment to working only with African photographers. So if we're doing a shoot in Tanzania, we'll work with a Tanzanian photographer. I guess it's a way of sort of redressing that historical imbalance. And it's a small thing that we can do, but definitely a positive step.
Rachel, what are your three top tips for NGO storytellers who are wanting to be more ethical in their approach to gathering images and telling stories?
Wow. So I guess the first one would be join the people in the pictures group. If your organisation is a BUN member, it's a fantastic community to be a part of. And I think you learn loads of really interesting lessons. You see lots of really concrete examples. We're sort of building a body of evidence of what is different and what works. And we also have some really helpful guidelines on ethical content gathering, which are available online, that were developed last year.
And I guess if you're in a country where you're not able to be a member of BUND, perhaps look at doing something similar.
Yeah, yeah. I still have some links with the sort of INGO community in France, and I think they're slightly behind where we are at the moment, but I know that they're starting to have those conversations too. Yeah, no, that's a really smart idea. The most important thing you can do, the most impactful thing you can do, is to give this work the time and space it deserves, and especially when you're doing content gathering, or whether you're or at the moment, I guess you're more likely to be commissioning stuff from a distance. Just, yeah, put in the time to develop relationships and really listen to people. And it's a luxury we don't always have, but maybe with the current setup, it's an opportunity. And I really think it makes a massive difference. And then I think the third thing I would say would be just to do it. And as I said earlier, I think that this is a fantastic time to be making changes and measuring their impact. I think that's really important, because we're a sector that operates very much on evidence and reporting and you know, accountability is really important. But I think, yeah, as an individual and as an organisation, thinking about what power you have and what changes you can make, or what changes you can encourage within your organisation, and just constantly being aware that you won't always get it right, and accepting that, and accepting being responsible and being accountable, I think, and just being committed to hearing that you've not done a great job, but willing to learn, and just self-awareness, I suppose, yeah, at all times.
Rachel, you've been fantastic. Thank you so much for mulling over these tricky questions with me.
Yes, thank you. It's been great. You definitely sent me a couple of zingers, but it has been a very stimulating conversation for me. So thank you so much for the time.
Thanks for listening to Storytelling for Impact. If you'd like to know more about the show or find out more about me, please visit my website at storytellingforimpact.net, where you can see all of the different ways you can contact me if you'd like to share feedback about the show. In our next episode, we'll be getting to know Ian Overton, an award-winning investigative journalist and author specialising in human rights and armed violence, about the impact he's been able to have during a career which has taken him to over 80 countries around the world.